I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. My guest today will be poet Patrick Rosal, and we will be talking about his latest book of poems, Brooklyn Antediluvian. We've had Patrick on the show in the past when his last book came out, which was called Bone Shepherds. So you might be familiar with him. You can go into our archives and check him out. I met Patrick about 6 or 7 years ago, maybe even a little bit more. I was doing a reading in Philadelphia. And as I was there, I realized, you know what? I don't really have to return back home for another, I don't know, week. So I decided I was going to take a train to New York City. You're probably wondering what the heck this has to do with Patrick Rosal. Well, I didn't know anybody in New York at the time, and I wasn't sure where I was going to stay because hotels are quite expensive there, especially if you don't make reservations. But a friend of mine told me, hey, you know, I have a friend named Patrick. He's a poet, and he lives in New Jersey, right next to the city, so maybe you can stay with him. So she called him, and Patrick let me stay with him. Didn't even know the guy, but he was very kind to me, and we got along really well, and we even hung out in the city one night. But I will always remember his hospitality. I think hospitality is an important value, and now I always will have a soft spot in my heart for Patrick. But I probably wouldn't have him on the show if he wasn't a great poet, and he is, and we're going to talk about his new book, so stick around. Patrick Rosal is the author of 4 books of poetry, and we are going to talk about his latest one, Brooklyn Antediluvian. He has also published Bone Shepherds, which was a small press highlight by the National Book Critics Circle and a notable book by the Academy of American Poets. He is also author of 2 other collections and has been honored by the Association of American Studies Book Award, the Global Filipino Literary Award, and many, many more. Patrick, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And let's start just by talking a little bit about that title, Brooklyn Antediluvian. Are we talking about the flood of hipsters that came into Brooklyn, or what are we talking about?
As a matter of fact, that's one of the floods that I think that I'm referring to in the book. I don't say it explicitly, but yeah, I mean, you know, there's a sense in a lot of neighborhoods and cities that are going through these really dramatic changes.
Yeah.
There's a sense of sort of not even a sense of history. I was going to say a sense of erasing history, but you have to acknowledge that there's a history there before you even erase it. And certainly that's something that's been happening in Brooklyn and Philadelphia, where I'm living now, and a lot of places in big cities around the country. It's about the floods of gentrification. But the book is really about many different kinds
right.
of floods, too. So, but that's certainly one of them.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you're old enough to remember a TV series called Welcome Back, Kotter.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But at the beginning, you know, they would just show images of Brooklyn. And and it was a much different Brooklyn back then than it is now. Yeah. And so what is your relationship personally with Brooklyn? Did you grow up there? Did you hang out there as a young man? Or
I didn't. I lived there for about 7 years. I just left Brooklyn in 2013 or 14. And in terms of like living there full time, that's the extent of it. My family's history goes there. My father moved to Brooklyn from the Midwest in 1964 and lived there throughout the latter half of the 1960s. And then they moved to New Jersey, and Brooklyn was sort of one of our, it was one of our holiday destinations because
wow.
My uncle Ernie and my Tita Candy, they lived in what's Hoyt Schermerhorn now. They actually, she still has her place down there in Hoyt Schermerhorn in Brooklyn, and I have a lot of very vivid memories of her apartment in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. The images of Brooklyn were fantastic, and you do kind of give this a street image of Brooklyn. A lot of the poems start off with, you know, boys hanging out in the streets, you know, but what I love about your poems, and this is true with, you know, Bone Shepherds and your other books, is you can follow the beginning of a sentence. You can be in Brooklyn, but then suddenly by the end of the sentence, you're in the Philippines. And it makes me wonder, how do you start a poem? Do you start it with like with an image or with an idea, or is it the unfurling of syntax, and you just kind of follow the syntax and are surprised even yourself sometimes where it ends up.
That's really astute. It's kind of all of them, you know. The long poem, the title poem of the book, started with a real-life encounter of me stepping outside of my apartment in Brooklyn and this kid saying that my sweatshirt doesn't fit. And that turned into probably a page or two-page draft that sat for a long time, maybe as long as a year. And when I went back to it one summer, it just kept opening up, and I was just following syntax and following the recurrence of images and following the music and the line. And that's kind of one of the pleasures of writing poems, is not trying to overdetermine where a poem is going.
Yeah.
That you can move geographically much faster in a poem than you can in real life, and that's kind of one of the wonders of language for me.
Yeah, you know, I'm a fiction writer, but I talk to a lot of poets on this show, and I read a lot of poetry to write reviews for them, and I think that the number one lesson I'm learning is, in my fiction, I'm learning how to just allow the syntax to lead me into the story, to lead me into the
mm-hmm.
landscape, and without trying to explain anything, because I think sometimes we have this tendency to try to get out of the poem or to get out of the story to try to explain things, whereas really, the language isn't going to let you down. It's going to take you where you need to go.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know about your experience, but it's a scary thing, because it feels like the poem or the story, in your case, it like you're letting it take control. And so for me, like there's often a voice in the back of my head, like, is this going to be a good poem? And losing control like that, you're sort of surrendering your agency for whether or not it's going to turn out to be a good poem. And so there's a measure of like being comfortable with being lost long enough to figure out what the poem is all about. And that's actually one of the pleasures, too, of just being lost for a while, I think.
It sounds like entering a poem is a lot like entering into a new city, because when you enter a city you've never been to, you probably are able just to kind of feel the energy, and you just kind of go this way and that and don't carry a tourist map and let the city reveal itself.
I love that. I think that's absolutely true. And it's, for me, it's the inner city, the city inside, not the inner city.
Yeah. Sometimes
the
that too.
It's the inward city of, you know, and it has a kind of, has its own cartography that doesn't reveal itself to you unless you travel through the lines of language. So I love that idea of entering an unfamiliar place.
How long did it take you to write this book, Antediluvian? And the reason why I ask is because I'm wondering if, when you started the book, did you start a book, or were you just writing poems that ultimately became a book?
I started writing the poems for the book even before the previous book had come out. So Bone Shepherds had come out in 2011. I was already writing poems that would become a part of Brooklyn Antediluvian. But I kind of just write from where I am and wherever I'm going. It might have been when the long poem started to take shape, I realized that I'd been really affected by floods, you know, Katrina, and then I was in a major, major typhoon in the Philippines in 2009, and that there was this sort of recurrence of water in my book, and I started to think about it a little bit more consciously. So to answer your question, I think that it probably took me around 5 years to write all of the poems that are in the book.
You know, one of the things I admire about you, Patrick, is that you have created and continue to create a life for you that allows you to write. So you do a lot, but nonetheless, you created a life that allows you to have that time to walk. And walking is writing. I mean, you know, you have that time to think and that time to follow the creative life. So I imagine that because that's the case, there may even be points where you are looking through your files and you say, oh my God, I have a book. I didn't even know it. Does that happen?
I think that might actually be what happens, is that I just get a critical mass of things. I throw them on the floor and then I just sort of look at them and I'm like, they start to kind of take a shape.
Uh-huh.
I think that I'm writing all the time. I just don't realize it.
You know, you are definitely one of the most successful poets that I know. But you know, you're a publisher. You have, you know, one of the best poetry publishers in the country, and you consistently get these great publishers. And so I think it might be helpful for our readers to know, do you need a particular writing space, or can you just write anywhere? Do you write in cafes? Do you write into your iPhone? I mean, how do you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm gonna give you a somewhat of a more abstract answer than a practical one. And it's because it's something that I've been thinking about really deeply lately. The one thing that I realized I really need is the movement between being social and being solitary. I need that, in some ways, the actual physical space doesn't ever really matter. I've written in airplanes and in cafes and in rooms and on streets and in my own house. But the thing that I know that feeds me is moving between contexts where I'm among people that I love, I'm among strangers, and then being able to return to a place of solitude and be able to reflect and write. So I imagine that I probably have some rituals, but in some ways the rituals don't matter if the fire is always burning.
Right.
And the fire for me is always burning when I'm talking with people and listening to their stories, or out somewhere and really observing and paying attention to the world and able to go back and reflect on what I just experienced or saw. So I don't know if that helps you out a lot, but I feel like, especially in this world where it seems like so much is encroaching not just on our physical space, but on our mental and psychic and emotional space, that it's important to say that one of the most important things for us to have is this movement between social and solitary worlds. I very much value my social life and my life of solitude.
Absolutely. We're talking to Patrick Rosal. His new book of poems is called Brooklyn Antediluvian. Your poetry is, quite frankly, and I mean this in a very good way, it's really hip, it's really young, it's really fresh. Yet at the same time, the craft is, you obviously know poetry and you know poets. And so I'm wondering, in your own poetry, what are some of the masters that you chop up and put into your work?
Well, in this book, one in particular is T.S. Eliot. I want to say something about that particular poem, but let me say something about T.S. Eliot first. So I never mentioned him in this book, but I'm referencing him, particularly in The Hollow Hollow Man. So T.S. Eliot's famous, he has a famous poem called The Hollow Man. And, you know, we get an expression that we use in English all the time. You know, you go out with a whimper, not a bang. Mm-hmm. And that's the last line of T.S. Eliot's Hollow Man. T.S. Eliot, I kind of have to go back into American history here, if you have a minute.
Sure, absolutely.
But T.S. Eliot, of course, as much as he wanted to be an Englishman, he was from St. Louis.
Right.
And the thing is that that meant that he grew up in St. Louis exactly during the time when Filipinos were on display. The 1904 St. Louis World's Fair, the biggest, most lucrative exhibition at that World's Fair, were Filipinos on display, and they encouraged them to act like, essentially, like savages. Why?
Oh, that's crazy.
Because the United States had just invaded the Philippines in 1899 and needed to justify that invasion and their imperialism by saying these people need to be civilized, even though they had been colonized by a European country more than 300 years before that. So there's these Filipinos on display in the St. Louis World's Fair. It is in the record that T.S. Eliot, as a preteen or a teen, went to this World's Fair. There's no way that Thomas Stearns Eliot could have visited the St. Louis World's Fair and not seen the Filipino exhibit.
Wow.
There's no way. And so if we take this sort of the logical conclusion of all of this, he goes on to be one of the most revered modernists among Stevens and H.D. and Pound and so forth. He also ends up studying anthropology, which is a discipline during that era that was also used to justify kinds of imperialism and colonialism.
Right.
T.S. Eliot is a part of this whole intellectual atmosphere about the savage and the civilized, and Filipinos play an essential role in the imagination of Westerners and Americans. And so when I saw T.S. Eliot's poem, The Hollow Man, you know, my sense of play made me think of the Filipino dessert, halo-halo, which is like an ice dessert, which literally means mix-mix. So in my mind, I thought about, I was like, this is so interesting. T.S. Eliot, who was sort of, who was, if not explicitly, obliquely about a kind of preservation of the purity of kinds of races, and one of our national foods in the Philippines is about mixing up things that don't belong together, halo-halo. He was talking about the hollow man. I said, well, you know what? We're the halo-halo man. We are the mix-mix man. We're the people who mix things together that you say don't even really belong together. So I know that that's sort of a long explanation, but I have great faith that when we teach history one day, that that's going to be a part of our curriculum, that I'm not going to have to do that whole explanation, that people are going to be like, oh, this poem isn't just about a dessert and about being Filipino. This poem is about being in conversation with a worldview that says, these people are savages and these people are civilized, and this is how it happened. And it played itself through through U.S. foreign and military policy. I have great confidence that one day we are going to educate people and that's going to make sense. Right now, I got to give you a 3-minute explanation for the poem, but that's cool because people enjoy the poem, I think, just for the rhythms of it.
Yeah. No, that's a fantastic answer. And that deserves to be an essay. Yeah, I mean, it really does. Because I'm sure you're the only one who has ever made that connection.
I'm sure I'm not. I'm sure. I think that there are Filipino scholars working on that.
Okay.
Actually,
right.
So that's why I'm confident.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. And what about Norma? How much time do we have, Norm? Yeah. Okay. I just want to make sure because we want to get you to read a poem at the end, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay,
yeah.
So I'm going to go on to a question about craft, because a lot of us, a lot of our listeners are poets, or they want to be poets, or like me, they just love poetry. And one of the things I've always wanted to ask a poet is about enjambment. And I'm looking at a particular line right now where it says, rocking, sometimes sadness is just. And that's the entire line. This on the poem Broke Heart, Just Like That.
Uh-huh.
So you have that line, rocking, sad, sometimes sadness is just. And of course, the enjambment encourages a reading, you know, to say that sadness is just. It's, you know, it's justified. But then, of course, the next line goes on to say what comes between the dancing. Sadness is just what comes between the dancing, which is really a beautiful line. But I wanted to ask you about how important it is for you to have lines that work on their own and then to subvert the meaning with the next line. Is that something that you consciously do, something that you make sure that you have in your poem? Because I think it's taught to a lot of students that, yeah, you should have these kind of enjambments. But I'm not quite sure how important it is.
It's definitely something. I mean, I think that it's something that certainly comes much later in the process. I'm really trying to just get language out on the page and get a sense of its music, and then later on I can start seeing possibilities of line integrity, like the one that you just read. So, you know, it's a part of being able to kind of create all kinds of layers of meanings, and each line ends up being a kind of element in a collage of language and images. So yeah, I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking about that all the time. That line in particular, I'm so glad. Like, you know, I also don't do it expecting that people are going to like actually go in and like see a line like that. But that's definitely what I was thinking about. Sort of the way that sadness and justice are related to one another. How we as Americans, especially American men, are disconnected from our own sorrow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the byproduct of that is often anger and rage. Mm-hmm. I line, I hope that that line does that kind of work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of the lines. I mean, I have a bunch of them underlined. And I think it's important for, poets, wannabe poets or poets who are emerging, to kind of hear that, hear what, how important that could be. We're kind of running out of time here, but I wanted to ask you one more question before I'd like to ask you to read a poem from the book. One of my favorite lines or ideas in this, which I completely agree with, I think I've said it in different language. You write that a poem is a field. Mm. How is a poem a field?
I think that I'm sort of referring to a lot of things. The idea that, the idea of the verse is supposed to be the turning of the line. The way that a plow turns as it turns the dirt up in a field. So there's supposed to be that kind of metaphor of the poem and farming. But also there's also Charles Olson and the poet is projecting the field of energy. And I think a lot of poets have sort of used the field as a kind of a metaphor for the field of the poem. This is another poem that sort of implies a kind of conversation an argument with T.S. Eliot, who in his really excellent essay about tradition, it's an essay that I go back to often. He talks about, sort of extinguishing the personality. It's a line that's used to discourage young poets from writing autobiographically. Mm. I don't think at all that autobiography is the only way to write a poem. But I do think that there is a self, if not an ego, there is a self that is always at stake in invention when you're writing a poem. So the poem is sort of considering, well, why was I taught in some spaces that it's actually good for you to extinguish this self. And then I talked about a literal, real field that mm-hmm. I entered, not just the poem of the field, or the field of the poem, but the field of the field, and what it was like, and what happens when the news of a murder enters that field. If I erase myself and I erase the murder, what's left of the field?
Oh.
So I want to bring into the field of the poem, I want to bring in our cruelty. I want to bring in our tenderness. I want to bring in our sorrow. I want to bring in our laughter and our carabaos and our uncles and our aunts. And I want to see what part of myself I can unconceal and I can discover by bringing it inside of this field of vision and this field of energy and this field of music.
Well, that's a fantastic answer, and at the risk of sounding corny, Patrick, you are outstanding in the field of poetry. Would you be willing to read a poem before we say goodbye?
Sure, I'd love to.
Awesome.
I will read the Scavenger's Ode to the Turntable, and I will say the thing that I wanted to say about it earlier was that Thomas Edison was pro-imperialism and pro-invasion of the Philippines. He made films of Filipinos being killed by American soldiers.
Oh.
The Filipino soldiers were played by black soldiers.
Wow.
So this poem is about me and my friends in Edison, New Jersey, where I did grow up. I grew up in the town where he invented the phonograph and the light bulb, chopping up his very invention that was used for imperialism. A scavenger's ode to the turntable, or a note to Thomas Alva Edison. We lifted the precious arm first, then the platter. We pulled free the belt and unscrewed the top. I didn't take shop or build a whole lot by hand, but I was pretty good with a knife. I poked the half dull blade clean and gentle through the turntable's plastic. I sawed down 4 inches straight as I could make it. Me and my boys, sons of cops, bookkeepers, and ex-priests, picked up gear other DJs didn't want no more. One prep school kid who just bought a shiny new mixer tossed out his 2-month-old Newmark, which we picked up from the garbage and hoisted home. We harvested the slider from the rich kid's rig. I stripped the wires' tips and soldered them to pitch contacts in a basement of a maple split in Edison, New Jersey. We were learning to turn anything into anything else. While our mothers played mahjong in the sala, and our fathers bet slow horses, and the government bombed Iraq, we learned to poise pennies on the cartridge head so the diamond stylus would sit deep in the vinyl's groove. A dance floor could turn from whining to riot quick if a record skipped when we spun back the wax to its cue. We stayed awake from noon to noon, digging out from crates some forgotten voice or violin to scratch. We juggled and chirped. We perfected the grind of a downbeat and dropped it on the bass line coming around, half trash, half hallelujah. Our hands cut Bach to Bambada and made a dance hall jump. We held one ear to the syncopated kick and the other to a future music that no one else could hear. Out of a hunk of rescued junk, we built a machine to mix the classics. We faded and transformed. We chopped up masters and made the whole block bounce.
That was one of my favorite poems in the book, but hearing you read it makes it even one of my more favorites. That was fantastic. In fact, if you're listening to this on streaming, I would encourage you to open up the book and on page 7 and listen to him read it as you follow along. It's a fantastic experience. At AWP in Los Angeles last year, your book was hot off the press and they were selling it. And my brother came up to me holding a copy and he says, "I got the last one. They're sold out." And he was very excited. So.
That's amazing.
Well, congratulations on this book. And we look forward to your next books and just to keep them coming, man. Keep them coming.
I hope to. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank my guest, Patrick Rosal, for joining me on Words on a Wire. The name of the book, Brooklyn Antediluvian. It's definitely worth your while to pick this one up. I'm Daniel Chacon. We'll see you next week on Words on a Wire.